buses left.
I'm Gretchen McGowan, and this is the first of two sessions on American church architecture. Today I will concentrate on the Lutherans and hope to bring us up through the 1960s, although I have a lot to cover. I hope to get that far. And then tomorrow we'll pick up the trail and spend much more time talking about contemporary church buildings and trends, and we'll get to things like the mega church complexes and that sort of business tomorrow. But today is more historical, thinking about what it means to build a Lutheran church, and in some ways that's a little bit of an arbitrary distinction, because Lutheran is just one variable that goes into the building of a church, and sometimes it's a relatively unimportant one. A lot of other things matter as well.
You lost your input.
I did. Is there a loose cable or something? So this is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, Lutheran church in America. It's not a Lutheran church any longer. It's now an Episcopal congregation.
Could you speak louder?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm trying to get this plugged in.
Could you speak louder?
I think so. Just want to make sure I don't lose that feed again. Okay, so this, I believe, is the oldest Lutheran church in America. This was a Swedish congregation. You may know that the Swedes settled, why does that say Philadelphia? This is supposed to say Wilmington, Delaware. The Swedes settled Wilmington and that area, which what's now Wilmington, and because the Dutch came and took over that colony, and then the English, they didn't have much of a chance to get a church started, but they built one in the 1660s, and then this one later in the 1700s. So when you look at a building like this, what sorts of things do you look for? What makes it Lutheran? What sorts of things are of interest to us as observers of the church and the times of the past? These are some things that shape a church. The ethnic makeup of the congregation. This is something that matters relatively little once you get beyond the immigrant phase of the congregation, but initially it certainly matters a lot, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with small Norwegian churches in the plains, and you'll see some features that hark back to that. Region also becomes very important because of three things. One is climate, which determines what kind of buildings are successful. Another is the regional traditions that develop. So churches in the Southwest tend to look a certain way by the 20th century, churches in the Northeast. And also region, less so once you get a good infrastructure of trains and so forth, but initially materials are determined largely by where the church is built. So you'll see frame buildings in some places, stone buildings in other places, and that's determined by what the builders have at hand. Of course, the size and the wealth of the congregation has a lot to do with what's built, maybe wealth even more than size. The age of the congregation, I don't mean the age of the individuals in the congregation, I mean, is this the first church built by a congregation? Is it the second? How established is this church in its community? Because churches tend to institutionalize, and once a church is an institution and has that sense of itself, it tends to build something that's more institutional, with all of, beyond the sanctuary, all the other components to a church plant. And finally, wider trends in architecture and also in liturgy. So if you have a movement, for instance, we'll talk a little bit about the Gothic Revival. The Gothic Revival is something that affects the church in the West. It affects the church in continental Europe. It starts in England, and it goes all across the denominations in the United States. So you can't say that that's uniquely Lutheran, but there may be Lutheran manifestations of that. And so what I'm doing primarily today is looking at Lutheran buildings, but what you're getting is also just a history of church building in the United States up to the 1960s. These are things to look for in the worship space when we're looking at these images. What does a worship space have to do? Well, it needs to shelter the congregation, and it needs to be comfortable in some ways. Now, comfort is something that's culturally determined. It's not universal. So do we need upholstery on the pews? Well, in the 1700s, no. By the 1800s, yes. So that, even heating, whether you see a stove in a church or central heating, that's something that's changing over time. In the Lutheran tradition, of course, it's word and sacrament. So we'll be looking for three focal points: the pulpit, of course, for preaching, the font, and the altar. And sometimes in the early churches especially, the font is something that's movable within the worship space. Style. Every church building has a style. Even mega churches that look like office buildings have style. And so this is how these churches participate in wider cultural trends. Ornament. Again, even the plainest churches have some sort of ornament. Even the religious traditions that are adamantly opposed to decoration do things that indicate that that space is special. It might just be running a plane down the side of a crossbeam that shows that someone's thought about the shape of that beam. But things are done to add ornament and style to a building. And of course, seating. How is a congregation seated? Are you seated in little boxes facing every which way? Are you seated in straight pews facing forward towards the pulpit? Are you in a large semicircular auditorium looking down on a stage? All of those sometimes dramatically change and affect the experience of the worshipers in that space. So those are some things to look for. Oh, and of course, music. Luther wasn't opposed to music, so Lutheran churches always, in some of the other traditions in America, this is something that comes along later when they decide it's okay to have organ music, for instance. But with the Lutherans, we see that from the beginning. Here's Luther in the Wittenberg Hymnal in 1524. Luther was friendly to the arts. Initially, he was more of an iconoclast, but when he saw with some of his colleagues how that sort of thing could get out of hand, he pulled back on that. And he says very little about architecture that's useful to us as historians. It's mostly kind of an open thing. And the intention is to use the arts in the service of God. So what that means in different congregations in different places is left open. This is the church where Luther preached in Wittenberg. Some of you have probably been here on pilgrimages to Lutherland. And the thing I want to talk about here is this wonderful altarpiece that you see in the back here. I'll give you a close-up of that. This is a mid-16th century altarpiece painted by Luther's good friend Lucas Cranach the Elder, installed in 1547. And here you see the offices of the church: baptism, communion, and confession. And I want to draw your attention to the predella, which is the lower part here. This is one way to think about Lutheran worship space. There is Luther in a pulpit. It's a fairly simple, unadorned space. And the image of Christ is in the middle, not literally. But you see what Luther's doing there? He has his hand on the Bible, and he's pointing and speaking the word of God, and the image of Christ becomes visible to the congregation in the preaching of the word. And that's one way to think about the ornament and design of Lutheran worship space. In the very broadest sense, this is something we see in church architecture over time. People like change and novelty, and trends come and go. So the pendulum swings from one side to the other in two ways. One is from a focus on transcendence to a focus on immanence. And transcendence, if you think of a transcendent space, it's a space that's beautiful, that's designed to awe the worshiper. People tend to be more distant from the sacrament. The seating is more formal. The chancel space where the altar is separate. And there's an emphasis on the clergy performing the work of God for the people. Immanence, on the other hand, is where the congregation is gathered together as a community. It's much more informal. The emphasis then is on the action of the congregation performing the liturgy together. And these, I don't mean to say it's always one or the other. Sometimes these things are mixed in together in a worship space. But whether a congregation values one or the other at the time of building will affect the way the space is designed. And another swing of the pendulum, and this kind of goes for culture in general, this is something else. Observation versus participation. So this is related to transcendence and immanence in some way. Observation is you have fixed seating, a central stage, and strong directionals. So you're all looking at me. I'm the one who's speaking. I don't expect that focus of attention to turn to that place over there for the next 10 minutes, and neither do you. So you're seated in a way that's towards me. For participation, spaces tend to be somewhat smaller. Movable seating becomes really an attractive option in the mid-20th century, and the focal points are scattered around. The other trend that I was going to say on the swing of the pendulum is towards ornament and away from ornament. So the Victorians get all excited about stuff, and then the modernists say, enough, we don't like that stuff anymore. And so it's this kind of, we don't like what our parents have, or some sort of desire for change, a desire to decorate, and then a desire to strip all that away. So you see this going on over time, too, often within churches. Now I'm going to show you pictures primarily of churches that have been restored to their original appearance by congregations who value that first period. But many churches, little country churches, were Victorianized. So they look very simple on the outside, then you walk inside and there's a red carpeting and an elaborate Gothic altar in the front and so forth. So these things can happen even within individual spaces as people respond to trends in style and trends in liturgy. Okay, this is a place to start. This is the Augustus Lutheran Church in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, 1743. My examples of Eastern churches are primarily German churches because that was a German part of the country as far as the Lutheran Church was concerned. These are immigrants coming in the 18th century largely through Philadelphia or New York and going out to the hinterland. This was the church of Henry Muhlenberg, and in this church you can see aspects of Germanic country tradition, but also some general things that apply to colonial churches across the denominations. They're fairly simple. The buildings look almost house-like rather than very churchy. Inside, the directionals tend to be that the main door is on the long side of the building, and when you walk in, you face a pulpit on that side. The pulpit is on one wall, the altar is somewhere else, so they're not all focused up front. In these early buildings, you often have box pews, which is a trend across the denomination. Sometimes they're facing different directions, which seems odd to us, but they're small spaces, and the action is moving around, and they also helped, those boxes help to keep the warmth in these unheated buildings, and some people even would bring foot stoves to church to heat their own space. There's a picture of the pulpit on the right. This, when I showed you the image of the St. Mary's Church in Wittenberg, this, the pulpit there was a later pulpit. This pulpit is very similar to 16th, 17th century German pulpits. A raised pulpit on a pillar below. This, the pulpit that Luther preached in looked very much like this. So the preacher goes up and says the word of God from above. There is something to the elevation of the office there, but a lot of this is simply for the acoustics of the space. Mm-hmm. You hear better if the speaker is raised. In fact, if I were to stand up here, you'd probably hear me better, but I'm lazy, so I'm gonna sit down. but the sound also echoes off that soundboard on top of the speaker. In the Puritan tradition, the emphasis was on the disembodied head. The body was supposed to disappear because the preacher was wearing these black robes and speaking very solemnly. So you would just see the head of Jonathan Edwards, for instance, speaking the word of God.
What's on the left? That wasn't for slaves, was it?
Not here. And gallery spaces were common in these early buildings. They were, or balconies, we would call them today, something like this. They were often removed later. These have been not removed, but in some of the churches they were reinstalled. The seating upstairs tends to be simpler. In some congregations, that's where the youth were told to go. And you're right, in some parts of the country there were special pews for slaves, although you don't see that in Lutheran churches as much, and not in these regions also. Here's another German church from the 18th century. This is the Palatine Church in Montgomery County. Again, entrance on the long side, the pulpit facing. This is a similar idea with the pulpit elevated and the soundboard on top. Stone and brick, because that was the local building material in these parts of central Pennsylvania. Certain German features, like the gambrel roof, are common, the gambrel being the four-plane on the roof with the sometimes hipped in on the side, but in this case, just a much more rounded barn-like roof is another way to think about it. This steeple has been replaced. The original steeple was much more conical, which is more in the German tradition, if you think about a cone, an inverted cone, or a cone, anyway, rising to a point, but without the different stages, which was the staged steeple like that is more of a English tradition. And in these parts of Pennsylvania, there's a cultural mixing of English traditions and Germanic traditions, and the English people tend to be those with the more power and money in the communities. So you see, especially in German houses in these areas, you see Germans doing things like making the outside of their house look English, but keeping a Germanic arrangement of spaces on the inside, which is very interesting. So they're trying to look fashionable outside, but keeping the inside something that's familiar. This isn't the case with this church, but you see this with later churches in that region. And I just love this image. Lewis Miller was a kid who grew up in York, Pennsylvania, where his father was a pastor, and he does just hundreds of these wonderful watercolors of life in the Pennsylvania German community there. And a lot of these are online. They're owned by the York County Historical Society. And this is an image that's not exact, certainly, but it shows you some of the culture of the interior of these churches, which I find very fun. You see the images of biblical figures across the top. There's Luther up there. I don't know if clearly this sort of thing, which you see on the woodwork, I don't know if you can tell the kind of spiraling up the pillars. That's a marvelization of the woodwork. That's a way of taking fairly cheap materials and making them look fancier, more expensive. So I think that's probably true. You get a sense of the smoke coming off of the stove there, which is constantly a problem for these buildings. They talk about the stoves clanking and smoking and generally making it hard to concentrate on sermons and other things.
It looks like that church would be big.
Well, it's not to scale, certainly. But there are a lot of people there. And you see the division into the choir and people chasing dogs around. And it's and actually depictions of worship. It's not all the sitting very still and paying attention to the preacher and being rapt if you didn't. There's a lot of this kind of chaos that happens in these churches. Not the Puritans in New England, but.
Chasing a dog.
Chasing a dog, yeah. Well, the animals you can kind of imagine would be around. There's legislation in England about keeping dogs out of churches at the same time, so I think it was a problem. Here's another Germanic Lutheran church. You recognize the similarities. This is in Charleston, South Carolina in 1763. This congregation was sparked by a visit from Muhlenberg, but in the 40s, the congregation didn't get started until the 50s. And this is their first building in 1763. Now, I don't know what you know about Charleston in the 18th century, but it was one of the wealthiest places in the colonies. A lot of influence from both London and the very wealthy places in the Caribbean, like Barbados, certainly connected to the Caribbean economy with rice and indigo and the slave trade. And the Germans were a minority in Charleston, certainly. So they're establishing a foothold there. Their early services are held in German, but anxious, I think, to be more trendy, to fit in a little more. And in 1818, they built this church. So this is 1763, and then just a little over 50 years later, this is what St. John's looks like. And it's bigger, the congregation has grown, but some really important changes have happened in this congregation, and this is a shift that's happening all across the colonies in a lot of different denominations at that time, called myself included, the Meeting House to Church Transformation. Now, this building is actually a Connecticut church from the same period. But these are the features that mark this major change, major reorientation of the worship space at that time. Entrance, rather than being from the long side, facing a pulpit with less sense of direction inside, entrance is now through a central projection or portico, often with a gabled end like this, on one of the short ends. That tower that's integral to the building, if you look back at this, whoops, sorry. See how the tower kind of appears tacked on to the side? It's not the main entrance. It's an important feature, but it's not integrated in the same way it is in these later buildings. There's a small interior space, the kind of thing we'd call the narthex today, but you don't walk right into the worship space. There's space there that's for meeting and greeting, and often on either side there are stairways that lead up to the choir loft or meeting rooms. Inside, this is probably the most important thing that affects the style of worship, is that the organization is very geometrically rigid towards the front. And this is what many of us are used to in worship spaces, where you have pews lined up and everyone's looking face forward at what's happening up in the chancel area. And in many of these churches, box pews, the old walled cubicles, are replaced by what they called slip pews. In fact, in the 19th century, they just called them slips. They didn't call them pews, where you could slip in easily. Yeah.
Why did they have the box pews originally? Is that a European thing?
It was the tradition. The history of pews is a great topic, actually. And in many of these churches, the church supported itself by people buying pews, or often for a yearly rent, but sometimes just, and they were exchanged like real estate in the communities. So imagine trying to set your whole church budget for the year based on what people bid for pew space. Not passing the plate every Sunday, but something that's much more market-oriented like that. So that has some bearing on the way that pews look at this time, too. That's a practice that continues well through the 19th century in many churches. And so this form of church, with the gabled end entrance and axial orientation inside, is one that we still see all over the place. It's a very common form. It's relatively easy to build. It looks like a church. If you ask a little child to draw a church, more often than not, you're going to get something that looks like this. It has a steeple, it has a pointy end, and it has a bunch of windows. And that's fairly simplified, stripped down. But if you want to build a building quickly that everyone will say, there's the church, this is a great way to do that. Next thing I want to talk about is this Gothic revival that I mentioned earlier that affects many denominations. And I want to start with Augustus Pugin. Name ring a bell? Maybe not. He's an interesting character. British, grows up Anglican, but converts to Catholicism in his 20s and loves the Middle Ages. Loves the Middle Ages. Thinks that everything since the Middle Ages has been decline. And he writes this interesting book before he even designs a church in 1836 called Contrasts, or A Parallel Between the Noble Edifices of the 14th and 15th Centuries and Similar Buildings of the Present Day, Showing the Present Decay of Taste. So on the left you have a wonderful neoclassical building, and on the right you have a wonderful Gothic building. Now, what do you think Pugin would not have liked about classicism or neoclassicism? Just a guess. Historically, what does that represent? Greeks, Romans, pagans. This is pagan architecture, and we've been building our churches as the pagans do. Now, you could say the same thing for Gothicism, actually, but Pugin doesn't see it that way. And he influences a young group of Cambridge students about the same time to start this Cambridge Camden Society, or the ecclesiology movement. It involves a lot of, I think, the bishop of the church in England and quite prominent people. And this is, the Gothic Revival is not just churches, Parliament. Westminster is built at the same time in the same Gothic style. And Pugin, in fact, worked on those buildings. So he's marking the beginning of a trend looking back to medieval society. He actually thought that the problems of society would be saved if we went back to a medieval model where he believed the church took care of the poor and the illiterate, and they looked to the church for direction. None of this unrest of 19th century Britain and that crazy working class. So he's looking for order, and he finds this in the medieval period, and then out of this springs a sense among many people, many denominations, that Gothic architecture is, capital T-H-E, the correct Christian architecture. And that has influenced far and wide. Victorian houses, Victorian decorative arts, many of these things have a Gothic mode as well. And at this time, the focus is generally Gothic. As you get further in the 19th century, it's all sorts of historical styles competing, and you see this in churches too. Gothic, Romanesque, Tudor, just a love in general. Victorians loved design history. They were far more literate in looking at a decorative element and telling you what the design origin was of that than people are today. We have a very complex visual world, but we don't understand it to the same degree, I believe. Yeah.
So if you go back to your previous picture, when I think about Baptist churches all over the United States, they all look alike to me. They look like that previous picture. And so how did they avoid this, as a community, avoid this movement?
Avoid the Gothic movement? Hmm. There are Gothic Baptist churches. Some of it depends on region. I think you'll see at the end when I'm talking about the 1960s, even the Lutherans in the South tend to prefer neoclassical architecture, even to today. Even megachurches in the South have white pillars on the front and they're brick, even though they have no relationship to neoclassical style in terms of geometry. So and then of course that's where the Baptists are strongest. So that's a partial answer to your question, but it's a good question. So these are some Lutheran Gothic churches. I'm showing you some later churches. Pugin thought that you should, in fact, go out and measure medieval English parish churches and rebuild them exactly in new places. He thought they were perfect. Why mess with it? And that doesn't go very far among many denominations. But you get pointed arches and interesting uses of stone and wonderful stained glass and things that go along with the Gothic look. This open structure inside is very common, where you see the Gothic arches in the inside of the building. And
Gretchen,
yes,
what I think is particularly
fascinating
about this church is that it was built by the Congregationalists, and the Lutherans took it over when they moved up Whitney Avenue about a mile and a half.
Yeah, do you know when that was? It wasn't too long after that. It was early 20th century.
Yeah.
I was surprised, too, to notice that in the 18th century churches, I was surprised to see Muhlenberg's church had a freestanding altar. And now we're into the 19th century churches, which are all up against the wall. It suggests that pendulum, perhaps, between transcendence and immanence. I thought the freestanding altar was a more recent development or renewal of that practice. I was surprised to see Muhlenberg's church was like that, but I don't know if you've thought about that at all.
Not in that specific instance, but there are many things that are converging here. It's not just the Gothic Revival. And here, this is another fabulous Gothic church that some of you may know, this building, Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church, which was built as a Lutheran church in Milwaukee in the 1870s. And certainly see the influence of the looking back to medieval Catholic church architecture. But many Gothic churches you could justifiably call Gothic, look like this. Mm-hmm. What is it that makes this church Gothic? Pointed arches on the windows, some buttresses on the side of the building. So there's a lean towards the style, but it's basically a cheap building that's small rectangle and functional inside. Now, another thing that happens at this time that's affecting the use of spaces and the orientation of the altar and all of that is a move towards what's called an auditorium-style church. And this doesn't have a dramatic impact on Lutheran churches. It affects more often the Baptists, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, especially in major urban areas. But two things are happening. Well, many things are happening. One is this influence of the Akron Sunday School plan, which is classrooms with movable partition doors surrounding an open space. So you're integrating the educational, community educational areas into something that's like an auditorium space. And that works best if the seating down below is in a semicircular arrangement facing a central stage. Another thing that you might suspect is happening is a more of a performance aspect to church worship, to preaching. Different relationship between the members of the congregation and the pastor. The best book on this subject is in fact called When Church Became Theater. So there, that's going on at the same time as some of these trends in style, this sense of congregation. So this is the mega church in some way already happening with a tiered set of pews and very large congregations, many of these, looking down on a pulpit that is set up as a stage. Preachers walking back and forth, choirs up on the stage, much more elaborate. Well, I don't know that it was entertainment, but it was certainly much more that than it was.
The sloping aisles.
You mean down, sloping down towards the stage?
Was that just a late 19th century development?
No, I've seen that in early 19th century congregational buildings in New England even, although it's often removed later on. And I honestly don't know. That was one thing I tried to figure out at one point. And in the records, it's very unclear why that's done. There are advantages. The sight lines are better and the hearing's better. But why in these little congregational churches that would happen, I don't know. And these are some examples of those kinds of churches. Fairly, this is St. Peter's. Now this has been replaced by a wonderful modern church, but St. Peter's German Lutheran in Columbus, Indiana, and the German Lutheran Church in Los Angeles. These are major institutional churches, and this style is very common at that time, kind of a corner building with a tower on one corner facing the street. And here you see the influence of the Gothic style, the influence of the Romanesque style, which would be tend to be rougher masonry construction, kind of rubble stone, rounded arches rather than the Gothic pointed arches. And these things get mixed together in the styles. And this is a very common church form at that time. You've probably all seen these late 19th, early 20th century buildings around the Midwest and the Northeast. And one of the reasons this church form is so popular across the denominations is this is the time from about the 1860s, 70s on with the rise of church expansion boards, especially among the denominations that are really focused on this, like the Methodists and the Baptists. And these church expansion boards provide plans, mail order plans, to congregations. And then when the neighboring church uses one of these plans, it comes from the Methodist church expansion board. The Lutherans might build something very similar. So I don't mean to suggest that everyone's having a mail order plan in front of every builder has a mail order plan in front of him, but that it's a style that starts with that. It starts with the great attention towards expansion among the prominent denominations and trying to help congregations by giving them what's considered good architecture. And churches I think from 1870 to 1890, the number of churches in the United States doubles. It's a tremendous time of expansion and of church building also. So many of them, because this is a style at the time, many of the buildings look like this. But we've also got small rural communities, often with first generation immigrants, just desperately trying to build something. And I'm sure that you all are familiar with these buildings, especially in Midwestern landscapes as well. This, for example, is Haugi, maybe, is that how you would pronounce that? Haugi Norwegian Evangelical Lutheran Church in Dane County, Wisconsin. Has anyone seen this building?
Is this the one that was moved to Luther Campus?
Could be. These are...
No, it's Old Muskego that was moved to
Luther. Old Muskego is at Luther. This one was, I'm going to make sure I get this right, A.C. Preuss. That's a name that I know has Lutheran residents. I don't know the history of that, but Preuss, is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Preuss. So, A.C. Preuss, 22 by 22 foot building, extremely simple. Really. So fieldstone foundation, log sides, on the inside just rough plaster against the logs, on the outside some clapboard. And I'm curious about this. These are images that come from The Historic American Building Survey, which is a product of the WPA that in the 1930s to employ unemployed architects and artists and builders, sent guys out in teams to document the historic architecture of America. And they're wonderful photographs that are now accessible on the in the Habs archives where they're digitized. So and the images tend to be better than ones I can get today because they're very clear, done with large format cameras, and they don't have the obstructions of 75 years of growth beyond that. So the buildings might not look exactly like this now, but I'm curious about this building on the right, and I thought some of you might, on this image on the right, there was a room at the museum where I used to work that was late 18th century German farm family in central Pennsylvania. And it was just the central sitting room of their home, but it had this really marvelous Baroque plastered ceiling. So farm family, middle of the country, fairly simple architecture. And I think I can see in this image that some of that is going on the ceiling there. But Evan, you've been to this building? Don't know. Well, I'm gonna have to track that down myself then. But there's also a typical pulpit right there in these buildings.
It looks like on a barn, what you put the hay in above the door. What was that door?
There is an attic space there.
Oh.
So that, gosh, I don't know. Maybe they stored things there. But it does look exactly like that, where you would hoist up things for dry storage. And these are the Habs drawings of the building as it was in the 1930s.
So there's no altar in the church?
It's kind of a combined altar pulpit, which was common in rural churches. So you have it's one structure with a table down below that serves as the altar. Here you can kind of see that here. This is the communion rail, the pulpit's there, and then there's something that functions as an altar. It's called the two-stage or double altar. Okay. This is the first Evangelical Lutheran Church in Sheldahl, Iowa. I'm trying to get all the ethnic groups for all of you, so I think I left out Finns, but I certainly have Norwegian, Swedes, and Germans. This is the first Evangelical Lutheran Church in rural Iowa, 1883. So moving forward, you're still getting these very simple rural buildings. This one's, I think, about 28 feet by 33 feet, so bigger than the other, but still quite small. And you see the parlor organ on the left there that was added sometime after that, probably not too long after the 1880s. Maybe an Esty organ, but basically a domestic organ put in this church because it was affordable and someone would crank out the, sit there and pump while they played. This is a better view of, can you see there's a little table like, can you see that in the front there on the pulpit on the right? Just sticking out, this is probably the best. Right here. Mm-hmm. See this? So that would serve as the altar, and it's just attached to the pulpit. And this is a wonderful building that's from North Dakota, 1903. Again, one of these fairly simple country churches, although much more like the Churchley plan from the early 19th century that we talked about a few moments ago. This has now been moved and is part of the Vesterheim Museum in Decorah. Okay, moving forward, in the 1920s, there's a liturgical reform movement that involves increasing formality in worship spaces. It's much more complicated than that, but for architecture it means that this kind of auditorium church of the 19th century has gone out of fashion, and people want churches to have the dignity of churches. Those are the sorts of terms that they use. And that gets back to an older sense of formality of church with the pews, more medieval. I'm jumping around so much, and I don't mean to say these things are all linear, but at this time in the 1920s, there's this movement towards the divided chancel plan. Sometimes on either side here, you'll have, on either side of the chancel, there'll be choir benches, so the choir is facing up in the front, and it's often elevated. So getting back to the sense of the work of the clergy being separate from the congregation, but the emphasis is on the kind of quiet spirituality, the dignity of that kind of worship, rather than the arena looking down on the entertainment. And this affects Lutherans as well. I'm going to get through this pretty quickly. This is Central Lutheran in Minneapolis from 1928, huge church, wonderful building. Another example of that in Baltimore in 1929, and Mount Olivet in Minneapolis in 1949. So this emphasis on formality, the Gothic Revival is continuing through this time. This is a kind of churches that were built by major congregations and minor congregations before World War II. Wasn't a lot of building in the 1930s and the 1940s because congregations were really struggling financially. So there's a point there where many congregations desire to build, desire to expand, don't have the resources, are thinking we're going to build in this style. And then the war happens and everything changes. There's a sense across the denominations, but the Lutherans are really leaders at this time in thinking about new types of architecture. I think in part because they're watching closely what's happening in Europe at the time, where modern architecture is really taking off, and looking at how the churches are rebuilding after the war. So here's a congregation that some of you mentioned before this session began. Christ Church Lutheran in Minneapolis. This is the building that they have before the war, the first church on the left there. And they're worshiping in the parish hall at the time because they've grown. And they have designs from the 1930s and 40s to build a church like this, not that big, but a Gothic church in this more formal divided chancel style. Then a young pastor comes along who says, let's not do this. This is wrong for our time. And the rhetoric of the churches at that time is, the war has changed everything, and we need an architecture that fits the world as it's been reshaped by these cataclysmic events. We need something that's modern. Gothic architecture was about a people who lived many hundreds of years ago. It's not about us today. We need to build things that are relevant, that draw in people, that make them feel that the church is theirs, not some dusty old institution from times gone by. So this church, this young pastor, talks to Eliel Saarinen, Finnish architect, well-known internationally. He's in Michigan. He gets the idea that he's going to ask Saarinen, who's extremely expensive, if he'd be interested in trying to design a modern church for a small congregation. And he presents it to him as a challenge. Can you do this? Can you do something that's affordable, that's workable, that's modern yet still worshipful for our congregation? And Saarinen, whose father is a pastor, is interested in these sorts of things, although I believe he only does 3 churches in his lifetime. And he says yes. And they figure out a budget, and of course the church costs 3 times what Saarinen says it's going to cost. But nonetheless, there's this wonderful landmark. Basically, a rectangle on the outside, looks a little bit like a fire station if you're just looking at the geometry, with a detached tower. And inside, it's just a marvelous space. Now, some of you have been here, I'm sure. It's the quality of the light is tremendous. The materials are wonderful. There's a soft reddish glow to the brick. That wall on the right side over there up above undulates gently towards the front. And it's one of the most worshipful spaces I've ever been in. And it becomes an icon for Lutherans at that time and has a big impact on other church building. I tried to find one of my slides of an Ed Sovic building from the early 50s that looks very much like this. So this Saarinen building affects Lutherans in the Midwest tremendously. And it's hailed immediately as an architectural masterpiece by people within the church and by the architectural community. I just want to show you a few more slides of this building since I love it so much. Nothing to do with what I'm talking about today, but one of the best educational wings I've ever seen was done by Eliel's son, Arrow, who agreed to take on this project, even though he was extremely busy designing the TWA terminal at Kennedy Airport and things like that. He and the arch, he does the arch or his father? Anyway, he's very busy. And he says, I will do it because that building is perfect and I don't want someone else to ruin it by putting an education wing next door that's schlock. So he actually builds something that's fairly low to the ground, doesn't detract from the original building, and it's a wonderful, well-lit, well-organized space, unlike the majority of education buildings from this period. the vast majority of education buildings from this period.
I'm from Minneapolis. What's the address? I've never been in this.
Someone will be able to explain it better.
3240 something, 34th Avenue South. It's, it sits on a double residential lot. There's houses just all around it. It's a very residential area.
Close to the Franklin Avenue Bridge, Lake Street Bridge, if you know.
Yes, it's 2 blocks south of Lake Street.
Being served by Pastor Christine Carlson, who's a regular holder person.
Yeah, she's terrific, and the American Institute of Architects has been around there. And if you walk in and find Christine or find someone in the office, they'll hand you a really nice self-guided tour where you can walk through. This education wing has a full gym in the basement, and it's sort of what money could buy if education wings were done correctly in that period. And one more slide, again, has nothing to do with it, but this is the best lounge I've ever seen in any church anywhere. It's like a boardroom. It's got, well, it's original Knoll furnishings. They have to lock up this room because the chairs in there are worth so much. So it's a glass wall on one side, teak paneling down two sides, a fireplace off to the left. It's just, you get what you pay for, I guess.
This was in the educational unit?
It's in the educational unit. This is Eliel Sun era designing the fellowship hall for the adults.
I think this church was just named to the National Historic Preservation List.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's usually it's a 50-year, you mean the National Register for Historic Places? Mm-hmm. It's usually 50 years. I'm actually working on a nomination for that right now. But mm-hmm. The buildings of this period are just reaching the age where they can be. Sometimes they'll push something through a little earlier.
I've heard that the acoustics are so good that it was used for recording.
It is, and Pastor Carlson says that they often have concerts there, and it's a very musical congregation. A lot of St. Olaf grads are drawn to it because of the acoustics and then like the congregation. They have wonderful music there, apparently. And this image appears everywhere of this church. This is an image of the chancel area in Christchurch, and it's on bulletin covers in Lutheran churches across America. So it's no surprise that this resonates with things like, here's the, Saarinen also does this, it's the Kramer Chapel at Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne. He did the whole campus. This is the son, the younger Saarinen, but the same kind of quality of light and attention to materials. And this, and the A-frame too, which is very popular at this time. You see that all over the place.
Are those solar panels on top?
No. And I think, so these buildings represent what's more architecturally significant among the churches of that period, the early influential buildings that other designers copied. But most of the buildings that we know from the post-war period, most Lutheran churches look like this. This, incidentally, was Martin Marty's first parish out in Elk Grove Village, Illinois. And he worked with Charles Stade to build a church that was inexpensive, that would work for a young congregation that was on the move. And I was struck by this when Fred was talking earlier this week about the God mobile and the cherubim on the wheels and God moving around, because the thought at this time was that the church was a people on the move, and sanctuaries needed to be like tents that sheltered you but weren't elaborate, that did the job, but then you would move on when God called you to move somewhere else. And that's one of the reasons they seem less substantial than early buildings. Another is because congregations had very little money at that time, and they were depending on new technologies that made church building less expensive, like the laminated trusses that you see here. And these are buildings that many of you know quite well, I'm sure, these post-war buildings. A few more examples. I think we're nearly out of time here. This is a very typical church from this period, a small A-frame church, again with those trusses, still oriented in that divided chancel way towards the front, slightly elevated. It's informal, but there are things about the worship space itself that still suggest a kind of fixed approach to worship and a kind of formality. That's the case in many of these churches. Just briefly to talk about the West Coast, which I know we're out here, I don't know enough about the buildings of the West Coast, but a West Coast architect, very well-known architect who had a big influence on church building, in this region using local materials like redwood and doing things that look Northwestern was Belewski, who did Central Lutheran Church in Portland. And a building that I actually know, this is in my hometown of Walnut Creek, California, from 1957, Trinity Lutheran Church, also designed by Belewski. The young pastor who came here had worked in Portland, knew about Belewski's work, had to convince this congregation to spend the money to hire this architect and to do something that was significant architecturally. And again, it's a really terrific building, very luminous. One of the reasons for that is that, I don't know if this is very legible in these images, but typically the walls of these A-frame or slightly rounded top buildings, the big construction supports coming down into the ground. But if you look, there are windows actually. There's a space between where the roof line comes down and the wall underneath. And that's the light from there coming through on the side. So the light in the building has a wonderful quality. And to get to your point about the South or the Baptists, in Lutherans were really leaders in the modern architecture movement in church design. I'm finding out it's a surprise to me how critical they were in the modern arts of the church, not just architecture, but all the fittings inside and the arts in general. Unlike in many other periods of church construction in America, that was sort of the heyday for Lutherans being on the cutting edge. And in the Midwest, in the Northwest, in the Southwest, the architecture of the vast majority of Lutheran congregations was modern, starting after the war. That doesn't happen in the South, just because of the regional, not that there aren't modern buildings there, there's some very fine ones, but there's also a great number of these colonial brick, white pillars, steeple buildings still in the South. I'm wondering why Lutherans were so receptive to modern architecture, and one of the ideas that I didn't come up with but that I've heard from others is that with the move towards modernism in church architecture, if the churches that have a strong liturgical tradition are more willing to experiment with design and style because they have that core to what happens in worship that they're secure with. And the churches where the space matters more and what happens is less determined and more flexible inside are less, feel less free to experiment with modernism. It's just one idea, but I think there's probably truth to that. One more example here, if you'll bear with me for 2 minutes. Edward Sovick is a really tremendously important Lutheran architect at this time. He's trained at, he goes to St. Olaf College, he goes to Yale School of Architecture. He works very closely with Arnold Flatten, who is his art teacher at St. Olaf, and then does a lot of reredos designs and pulpit designs in his buildings. Sovick starts building buildings like Christ Lutheran, rectangular with the detached tower, but he develops a very clear theology of buildings through the 1960s, and he writes Architecture for Worship, I think about 1970, and his sense of proper, not just proper Lutheran architecture, but proper Christian architecture goes way back to what he believes the early church is doing. It's having a center for the congregational participation in the liturgy without a central fixed point. So you make a square space, and these are all possible arrangements of the, so you have a platform rather than a fixed chancel, and that platform can move around the space. And I, one of the really beautiful church in this style from the 60s, and I wish I had an image of it, is in, it's Westwood outside of Minneapolis, in a suburb of Minneapolis. Anyone know where I'm talking?
Westwood building.
Hopkins,
he did one there. So anyway,
West
St. Louis Park, that's the one I'm thinking of. It's just tremendous, worth going to take a look at. And this is a Methodist church he did in Charleston, but that's the only image I had. But you get the sense of the inside, and a lot of his buildings look like that. They're in fact quite majestic spaces, and one of the scholars who studied Sovick's work recently says that Sovick elevates the imminent over the transcendent, that is very much about people worshiping God in community in places that don't have a sense of the transcendent. But Sovik very much disagrees with that. He says, just because they're simple spaces, they're beautiful spaces, isn't just beauty a way of accessing the transcendent? And I encourage you to visit his churches if you can find them, because they do, I think, have a kind of transcendence to those spaces. He tends to focus on really high quality materials, and that also contributes to that sense of beauty. And I think I'm done. Oh, very strange things happened in the 1950s and 60s too. I hope no one's here from Fremont, Nebraska. I actually like this, but it is strange, I think you'll agree. And especially with folded poured concrete, once that technology was available, architects seemed to want to figure out everything possible they could do with folded concrete. And so you see churches that look like spaceships and other things on this floor. And this is interesting because the roofline relates to the chapel at Valparaiso University, Charles Stade, 1959, and I will end there for today. Questions? Yes.
If you have a chance to visit in Minneapolis, Our Savior's Lutheran Church, which, just can someone help me, is less than 10 years old, isn't it? Replacing an old church which was burned down, is one of the best examples of a church that allows light in, but also has a glass wall so that it relates to the world outside. And yet, it's a very movable space. There are no pews, there are chairs, so it's and the congregation has made use of that space, rearranging so that in Lent, for instance, they are in a sort of a circle around the altar.
This is new, you said, within the last 10 years or so.
Our Savior's Lutheran. Is anyone here familiar with it on Chicago and
24th?
Thanks.
And I don't know the architect, but...
I'll see if I can find out. Yeah.
Could you explain why it is that a lot of churches are no longer using pulpits and things like that?
No longer using pulpits. You mean there's no fixed place for preaching, or the pastor just walks across a stage in the front, around the... Yeah, that's a great question.
That one has the stairs and the...
Yeah, that's a very formal chancel. This is different because it was designed not only to be a place of worship, but also to be the primary place of assembly for a student body. In fact, some of the earlier designs or ideas for this suggested that there would be some kind of divider between the nave and the chancel, so that when you didn't need the chancel, you could shut that part of the building off. That didn't happen, but it was conceived of almost as two. Ed Sovik has visited this space, and he said he never liked it because it was chaotic. There wasn't a sense of coherence that he desired in his centrum plan buildings. I love this building, but your question about pulpits. My kids asked me this recently because we have a pulpit in our church, and depending on who's preaching, he or she will or will not use that. Sometimes stand in the front, sometimes use the pulpit. It seems to be open.
Perhaps it was a trend or something.
That may be. I think it relates to concerns about being, well, maybe some of you in here who preach could answer that question better. What's happening? What are you told in seminary about using a pulpit? New churches that I've seen still have a place for that. So more often what I see is pastors not using it rather than omitting it altogether. So your example's interesting. In the early, say about the 1830s, when you think about all the revivalist preachers really taking off, they had the same sort of thing. The pulpit sort of stretched out so that rather than this little box that you sat in as a disembodied head, you had this stage that you could walk back and forth on and gesticulate and preach the word in a way that really engaged the congregation. So,
TV and evangelists, you know, are getting more prominent, and that's their style too.
Yeah, sometimes with, say, a plexiglass pulpit, so it's there holding notes or books, but you can't really see it. I don't. it matters. It matters to the congregation how the congregation feels about their relationship with the pastor, I'm sure. But I don't know.
I've been fascinated by your mentions of architects who think theologically about space and...
Most of them don't, I should say, too. Yeah, it's pretty rare that they do.
Sobeck and the Finnish one, too. Yeah, right. It reminded me of the chapel at the seminary that I went to, Pacific Lutheran Seminary in California, the Chapel of the Cross, which is a beautiful building, Spanish tile, and very appropriate to its setting. But there was a, this could be an apocryphal story, but there is not a window in the entire chapel you can't see out. And it's a beautiful, beautiful setting up at the top of the Berkeley Hills. You can see out, and there's beautiful trees. There were gorgeous, gorgeous campus, but not a window anywhere in the chapel. And the story was circulating that the person who designed the Chapel of the Cross didn't want the students to be worshiping nature while they were coming to the chapel, or maybe just the distraction of it was maybe the kernel of truth. But there's, as the story goes, there was a theological concern in the way the building was put together without a window in the place.
Well, you can see that a couple of you have brought up this question of the interface between the space and nature, and that's a question that modern church architects are thinking about a lot. That's something we'll talk about tomorrow. And many churches now are deciding to just have an open window behind the pulpit area. But here you see one solution to that, which is you have these kind of louvered windows. So if you're in the pews facing forward, you don't see out because the light's coming in from the side, so there's nothing to distract you or blind you. I guess there's a problem with light behind a speaker too. Thanks. Thank you.